Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Clergy and people of the Diocese of New Hampshire, trusting in the guidance of the Holy Spirit, have chosen Gene Robinson to be a bishop and chief pastor.
In November of 2003, the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire made history by consecrating the world's first ever openly gay bishop, Gene Robinson. Though extremely controversial, Robinson's elevation was seen by many as a victory for a more open and liberal-minded Protestantism and for a religious inclusiveness that has not disappeared from America in spite of the headline-grabbing fundamentalist movements of recent years. Bishop Robinson's ordination might well have happened in San Francisco or New York City, but if you think about it, New England is just as likely a setting for such a historic event. After all, our region has embraced religious reform and new ideas for centuries, and in northern New England especially, an ingrained live-free-or-die libertarianism means that political and social opinions, whatever they may be, don't find their way into church quite as much as they may elsewhere. Bishop Robinson himself thinks this may say something about who we are as New Englanders.
It's probably what people don't understand about us around the country, which is that there's this fierce devotion to individualism and to the right of people to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in any way they see fit, as long as it doesn't interfere with my right to pursue that. And I think in some ways that kind of rugged individualism sometimes even supersedes the religious beliefs. Anyone who wears their religion on their sleeve is a little bit suspect. Whereas in other parts of the country, my experience is, one of the first things people ask you is, where do you go to church? And I think in that sense, people here in New England are just very wary of asking, inquiring about another person's religion or sharing their own.
The private, apolitical, religious attitudes of many church-going New Englanders today are a world removed from our beginnings, when Puritans and pilgrims came here to escape persecution in England and to create what they called a nation of God on earth. The Puritans' vision of life in the New World had many virtues, but religious tolerance was not one of them. Once established, the founding fathers of our region presided over some of the most shameful events in our history, including the slaughter of thousands of heathen savages, as they called Native Americans, the hanging of women and men accused of witchcraft, and the banishment of numerous others for offenses as trivial as minor disagreements over church doctrine. Obviously, we've changed, but how and why? How did our region develop from one of the most publicly orthodox, intolerant, and spiritually rigid of places to one where religion tends to emphasize diversity, affirmation, and privacy? A place, in short, now thought to be among the least religious of any in the country.
Today, for the final installment of Storylines New England, we look at the roles that religion, faith, and spirituality have played in our region, from the Calvinists to the Congregationalists to the Catholics, and how religion has shaped us as New Englanders. We'll also talk about a powerful book by a contemporary New Hampshire author, called the Dickens of his day, that examines the power of faith, hope, and miracles. Once again, Bishop Gene Robinson.
There is something scrappy about New Englanders. I think we've had to be inventive. We've had to be very smart about survival here because survival here isn't very easy. Consequently, I think our spirituality is a bit scrappy and creative as well. And part of the scrappiness is courage. So you have a lot of movement towards the abolition of slavery coming out of New England. You've got Underground Railroad coming through here. I think it just comes out of who we are and geographically where we live and what our heritage has been, from the freewheeling and fairly open Rhode Island to the very much more conservative and controlling Puritans in Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's an exciting place to be doing religion because we're always looking to do the next new thing.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Throughout these 13 weeks, Storylines, a project of the American Library Association, has looked at the literature of our region as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. We've read from the works of Mark Twain, Stephen King, Grace Metalius, and Annie Proulx, to name a few, and looked at the issues these and other New England writers have raised, among them the Native American experience, the limits of tolerance, the fate of the family farm, and our relationship to the sea.
Our goal? To gain a better sense of where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading as a region. This week on Storylines, we end our series with a look at the role religion, faith, and belief have played in New England as we turn to John Irving's novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany. National Book Award winner and New Hampshire native John Irving begins his novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany, with what he once said is the best opening sentence he's ever written, mostly because, for him, it sums up the entire 617-page novel.
I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice, not because of his voice or because he was the smallest person I ever knew, or even because he was the instrument of my mother's death, but because he is the reason I believe in God. I am a Christian because of Owen Meany.
Irving's 1989 novel was written to answer a question he'd carried with him since his student days at a famous New England prep school. What would be the magnitude of the miracle that could convince me of religious faith? A Prayer for Owen Meany tells the story of the friendship of John Wheelwright, an average but fatherless boy from a long maternal line of Yankee bluebloods, and his diminutive friend Owen Meany, a working-class genius with a pinched and haunting voice. Owen's friendship with John begins in their small New Hampshire town of Gravesend, evolves as the two attend the prestigious Gravesend Academy, and ends tragically against the backdrop of the Vietnam War and the tumult of late 1960s America.
Owen Meany believes that he's an instrument of God, and his life is an accumulation of small miracles and events that defy coincidence, from the baseball he hits that kills John's mother, to his obsession for slam dunking, to the memorable Christmas pageant that ends up foreshadowing his death. Every moment of life, he repeatedly argues, is part of God's larger design. A Prayer for Owen Meany examines the power of faith and miracles, and at the same time bitterly attacks the hypocrisies, confusion, and contradictions of organized religion, something John Irving makes quite clear after his famous first sentence.
I make no claims to have a life in Christ or with Christ, and certainly not for Christ, which I've heard some zealots claim. I'm not very sophisticated in my knowledge of the Old Testament, and I've not read the New Testament since my Sunday school days, except for those passages that I hear read aloud to me when I go to church. I'm somewhat more familiar with the passages from the Bible that appear in the Book of Common Prayer. I read my prayer book often, and my Bible only on holy days. The prayer book is so much more orderly. I've always been a regular churchgoer. I used to be a Congregationalist. I was baptized in the Congregational Church, and after some years of fraternity with Episcopalians, I was confirmed in the Episcopalian Church too, I became rather vague in my religion. In my teens, I attended a non-denominational church. Then I became an Anglican. The Anglican Church of Canada has been my church ever since I left the United States about 20 years ago. Being an Anglican is a lot like being an Episcopalian, so much so that being an Anglican occasionally impresses upon me the suspicion that I have simply become an Episcopalian again. Anyway, I left the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians, and my country, once and for all.
John Irving draws a lot from his own life in this novel. Irving was born in New Hampshire and attended Phillips Exeter Academy, where his father taught history. Like his fictional characters, he passed through the turmoil of the late 60s, sometimes living in Europe and at other times working as a writer and professor in New England. John Irving was a regular churchgoer as a boy. He was influenced, as countless New Englanders have been, by his New England church experience, its teachings, its unique regional attitudes, and the indelible imagery of its presence in our landscape. The white Congregationalist meeting houses, abutting town greens, the Catholic spires that reach for the sky over our towns and cities, and in other buildings, old and new, the spiritual homes of Baptists, Mormons, Methodists, Jews, Eastern Orthodox Christians, and now even Muslims. Religious presence is a deep part of New England's culture and history, from God-fearing Puritans to the Roman Catholic mill workers, and on to today's growing numbers of evangelical Protestants.
Today on Storylines New England, as we end our celebrations of Hanukkah, Christmas, and the solstice, we look at the roles religion, spirituality, and faith have played in our history, our culture, and in our identities as New Englanders. through the pages of John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany. And we want to hear from you, your stories. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. How do you think that religion has formed the character of New Englanders? Is there anything unique about New England's churches? And what parts of New England's religious heritage do you still see reflected in our culture today? Join us 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us in the studio is David Waters, professor of English at the University of New Hampshire and director of the Center for New England Culture. He's also been our consultant here at Storylines New England. Hi there, David. It's great to have you back.
Well, thank you, Kevin, and good evening, Aura.
And from the studios of Connecticut Public Radio, we're also joined by Professor Andrew Walsh, an assistant professor of history and religion and associate director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And Andrew Walsh is also the editor of the book Religion and Public Life in New England, published just last month. Welcome, Andrew Walsh.
Thank you. Good evening.
And David Waters, I want to start with you with a great big broad question, because we need to really create some context here for our discussion of A Prayer for Owen Meany. Would you set the scene for us? Give us some sense of what New England's spiritual landscape, its church landscape, was like at the very beginning, 300 years ago, as the colonies were just being established.
Well, we think of the New England mission. People who came here, we call them the Puritans and the Pilgrims, who had a belief that they were God's people, a new Israel. And this led to formation of Bible commonwealths and certainly a New England conscience, a deep self-analysis as to whether or not one is fit or is racked by sin and is able to be one of these visible saints. And also social ideals, that is this New England living up to that status of being a new Israel, and is it reformed itself enough, and can it be a light unto the nations and a leader of the United States eventually in its moral mission?
Mm-hmm. Andrew Walsh, give us a little of your input on that question. For instance, was New England spiritually pretty unified at the very beginning?
Well, if you look carefully, there are always divisions, but mm-hmm. by our standards, yes. It was a remarkably uniform and homogeneous place, and there are a couple reasons why, but the most important is that the founders of this place came not really to establish a Bible commonwealth here, but to show the rest of the English that their version of the Protestant Reformation was right. That's what the whole city on the hill thing was about. And the twist in New England history is that almost as soon as Massachusetts and Connecticut were settled in the 1630s, there was a civil war in England that rendered that whole discussion moot because the Puritans won. And then they lost. And the New England Puritan colonies spent the next 200 years more or less hiding from the English government. People didn't migrate after the 1630s, and New England was kind of a dead end for 150 or 200 years. And that developed an enormously specific and very rich culture that was in many ways sealed off from other parts of the English world until the middle of the 18th century.
I think it's important to understand how much the Puritan experience in early America was affected by political and religious events in England, as you point out.
Right.
You know, John Irving makes a point in A Prayer for Owen Meany of dragging his protagonist, Johnny Wheelwright's heritage, all the way back almost to the beginning of New England's religious history. And we have a little reading about that, discussing the line of descent, so to speak, and line of dissent that's in Johnny Wheelwright's family.
According to Wall's History of Gravesend, New Hampshire, the Reverend John Wheelwright had been a good minister of the English Church until he began to question the authority of certain dogmas. He became a Puritan and was thereafter silenced by the ecclesiastical powers for nonconformity. I feel that my own religious confusion and stubbornness owe much to my ancestor, who suffered not only the criticisms of the English Church before he left for the New World. Once he arrived, he ran afoul of his fellow Puritans in Boston. Together with the famous Mrs. Hutchinson, the Reverend Mr. Wheelwright was banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony for disturbing the civil peace. In truth, he did nothing more seditious than offer some heterodox opinions regarding the location of the Holy Ghost, but Massachusetts judged him harshly. He was deprived of his weapons, and with his family and several of his bravest adherents, he sailed north from Boston to Great Bay, where he must have passed by two earlier New Hampshire outposts, what was then called Strawberry Bank, at the mouth of the Piscataqua, now Portsmouth, and the settlement in Dover.
You're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy, along with Kevin Gardner. Today on Storylines, we're talking about faith and spirituality and our region's nearly 300-year history of religious development and change, all against the sprawling backdrop of John Irving's 1989 novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany. It's a book that combines religious and political elements with a heartfelt coming-of-age story set mostly in a New Hampshire prep school town. We want to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about how New England approaches religion. Again, how that question is reflected in A Prayer for Owen Meany. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And David Waters, just diving into the book for a moment, what role does religion play in this book, A Prayer for Owen Meany? And how does it, and John Irving, the author, reflect New England's religious attitudes?
Well, the book really presents that kind of struggle over what's authentic faith. John Wheelwright comes to America to find religious freedom, and then he gets persecuted and ends up in New Hampshire. And then when he's in New Hampshire, he makes a deal with the Indian Sagamore Wanahantawet and essentially steals his land. And it's that kind of original sin that is in the book. And Irving talks about it being original sin in going to Vietnam or are going in the Iran-Contra controversy, that if you believe you're doing good and you're doing God's will and yet you're actually serving your own interests, how does that play out in history? And for Owen Meany, and for Johnny Wheelwright, trying to figure out how the evil of errant baseball killing John's mother, or how a vision that Owen has that he will be God's instrument to save children at the end of the book. I mean, how do we know that God's voice is really speaking to us and that we're, you know, following that will, or are we actually creating our evil by following our own self-interest in the name of religion?
And a bit about John Irving himself, David. You know, how much is John Irving the main character in the book, John Wheelwright, the young boy in the book who's basically your blue blood Yankee and his best friend Owen Meany? How much of John Irving is Johnny Wheelwright, and how much of Johnny Wheelwright's spiritual quest is the author John Irving's spiritual quest?
Well, you know, surely John Irving went to Exeter Academy, and his stepfather taught there, and his mother, the wonderful presence of that family in town, and he really presents Exeter very well. And he got from Exeter not only that great kind of spiritual questing and intellectual heritage, but I think he also felt something else, that there was a kind of a class discrimination of the Protestant Exeter against the Irish Meanies, for example, in this book. And then I also think that he really takes from it a profound sense of a search for mothers and fathers can be relied on, that growing up in the Vietnam era, that the national father, Kennedy, seems to betray the country in this book by having an affair with Marilyn Monroe and leading him into Vietnam, and then Reagan seems to betray the country. So how do we get the mother back here? And that's the Catholic faith, really, in the book. How do we get the mother image, the forgiveness, the love back into these people's lives?
Again, the number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. And Andrew Walsh, a question for you. David touched on it, but I'm interested in what you think about, is there something that typifies a New Englander's attitudes about religion, no matter what the denomination? You know, is there sort of a shared outlook on religion today?
I guess I'd agree with Gene Robinson and say extreme caution about discussing religion in a public setting. But I think I would disagree with him about the cause, and I think that it really is the result of a lengthy, lengthy struggle between Protestants and Catholics that sharply separated New England until the 1950s or 1960s, and that's still perceptible in many places in the region. People don't start the fight unless they really want to have it.
We see in the excerpt we just heard, Andrew Walsh, that fracturing in the hard armor of Puritan dogma occurs almost immediately upon arrival here in New England. Could you bring us forward from that time to today and as efficiently
it's
as possible?
It's a 400-year trip, okay.
In two minutes or less.
This is really the how did we get here from there
I guess I'd say
question.
That historians think somewhat differently than novelists. about the history of Puritanism, and tend to be impressed by how cohesive rather than how fractured it was. Most things are fractured. But New England Puritanism retains its shape into the early 19th century and transforms itself slowly into a much more voluntaristic organization. The revival is invented here, and Protestantism softens considerably. New England until the 1830s is an extremely homogeneous, very Protestant place. And then beginning soon afterwards, there is a and actually before, there's a division in Protestantism between people who are moving towards post-Enlightenment kind of ideas and those who are struggling to maintain pre-Enlightenment notions of Christian orthodoxy. That becomes kind of a crisis at the end of the 19th century. And I'd say that what's striking about this region's Protestantism is that almost all Protestants in New England become liberal or moderate Protestants at the end of the 19th century. Lock, stock, and barrel.
You know, there's a kind of odd contradiction in some of the imagery of New England's religious experience, isn't there? Because on the one hand, you have that homogeneous, heavy-duty Puritan ethic, and yet on the other hand, we're often called one of the least religious areas in the country. How did we get that reputation?
Well, it's a bad reputation. That needs to be refined. New England is about average for the United States, but it skews two ways. And the first is that southern New England, where most of the people live, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, is an extremely Catholic place. It's like Utah is Mormon. And affiliation rates are very high. Northern New England, which is where you are and much more lightly populated, is secular and unchurched and has much smaller Protestant and Catholic congregations, and they're kind of struggling at the beginning of the 21st century. And I think that the so far as religion goes, vitality shifts in the 19th century mostly to the Catholic side, and that's where it is today.
And that's so striking, Andrew, because, again, that's not the image that people have of New England.
No, but you need to understand that New England is unbelievably Catholic. About 60% of the population or of the adults tell public research pollers that they have a Christian identity of some sort or another. Of that group, 70% are Catholic.
You know, I'm glad that we're talking about this tension between Catholics and Protestants in New England, because it comes up in the book, A Prayer for Owen Meany. We're going to hear a reading now where Owen Meany, whose parents are Catholic, he's in church, he's in the Christmas pageant, he's playing baby Jesus, and he looks out at the audience and sees his Catholic parents sitting there in the audience in this Protestant church.
Owen sat up so suddenly in the mountain of hay that several front pew members of the congregation were startled into gasps and cries of alarm. He bent stiffly at the waist, like a tightly wound spring, and he pointed with ferocity at his mother and father. To many members of the congregation, he could have been pointing to anyone, or to them all.
"What do you think you're doing here?"
the angry Lord Jesus screamed. Many members of the congregation thought he meant them. I could tell what a shock the question was for Mr. Fish, but I knew whom Owen was speaking to. I saw Mr. and Mrs. Meany cringe. They slipped off the pew to the kneeling pad, and Mrs. Meany covered her face with both hands.
"You shouldn't be here!"
Owen shouted at them. But Mr. Fish, and surely half the congregation, felt that they stood accused. I saw the faces of the Reverend Lewis Merrill and his California wife. It was apparent that they also thought Owen meant them.
"It is a sacrilege for you to be here!"
Owen hollered. At least a dozen members of the congregation guiltily got up from the pews at the rear of the church to leave. Mr. Meany helped his dizzy wife to her feet. She was crossing herself repeatedly, a helpless, unthinking, Catholic gesture. It must have infuriated Owen.
A reading from John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany, and that's the book we're talking about today on Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with my co-host Kevin Gardner, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your calls. We want your thoughts and your stories about New England's attitude and approach toward religion. Join us 1-800-892-6477. And David Waters, we're still chuckling from that.
what a funny reading. You know, there's an 11-year-old playing the Christ child, and he's an angry Jesus. And what 11-year-old wouldn't love to put down his parents? But, you know, what it is for Owen is that his parents have apparently told him he's the product of a virgin birth, that they never did it. And he has never gotten any love from his mother or his father. And the only mother love he's gotten from is from Johnny Wheelwright's mother, who had Johnny out of wedlock, is seen as a Mary Magdalene figure. But that's where he gets his love. And it really, I think, gets to that other part of the New England conscience, both Catholic and New England, about a substitution of purience about sexual sins for real morality. And this is a lot of what this book is about, is to get away from that image of the kind of introspective searching out sin and sexuality and other people, and think about the bigger issues of, you know, do we love the poor? Do we take care of children? Do we love children?
Is that the tension, then, as you see it, between New England Catholics and Protestants, these attitudes towards morality and sexuality?
Well, I think, oddly, they both get shared in this region. They blend quite nicely in that obsession in some ways. But, you know, as Owen Meany and Johnny Wheelwright say, is that why as Americans do we care more about whether our president has a penis or about whether he's lying about going to war? And this is really what it comes down to, that sense of conscience. Who's going to break through that to love the sinner?
Andrew Walsh, just another contemporary question.
Yes.
We've talked about, you know, the Protestant heritage and the Catholic heritage. But what about today? I mean, does New England see the same huge religious diversity that you see in other parts of the country, you know, Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and so forth?
Of course. It's present. It's a modern American circumstance. But New England is much less diverse than other parts of the country, especially northern New England. And although there are communities of Muslims and Hindus in Connecticut and Massachusetts, they're very scarce on the ground in northern New England. There are Buddhists around, but the percentages are small, although in places like Vermont and western Massachusetts, there are many former Christian and former Jewish or mixed affiliation people who identify with Buddhism. There are some counties in Vermont and western Massachusetts which might have a Buddhist population of 4 or 5%, which is a lot of Buddhists.
No, that's sort of people who look like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants,
right.
but practice
Buddhism.
You've
got to stack that up against 65 or 70% Catholic and 15% or so mainline Protestant and 5% or so conservative Protestant.
All right, coming up after a break, more on the spirituality, faith, and the New England Church, along with John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany. We'll start taking your calls, too, so do give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides.
Also, as we close these 13 weeks of Storylines New England, we want your feedback, your thoughts, what you liked about the series, if you'd like to hear more of Storylines in the future. Let us know what you think. Send your comments in an email to publicprograms, all one word, at ala.org. That's publicprograms, all one word, at ala.org. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Thank you.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand ourselves as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today, we're reading from John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany and looking back at our long history of religion, spirituality, and faith. A Prayer for Owen Meany is a story about hope, belief, and friendship. Its protagonist is John Wheelwright, an average Yankee boy whose best friend Owen Meany is a childlike visionary with a pinched and haunting voice who believes that he is God's instrument. Irving's book looks at the complex and at times hypocritical history that New England has had with religion, never hesitating to criticize contemporary political developments or to editorialize on the spiritual qualities of preachers from rival denominations, frequently with humor and more than a little irony.
What made Mr. Merrill infinitely more attractive was that he was full of doubt. He expressed our doubt in the most eloquent and sympathetic ways. In his completely lucid and convincing view, the Bible is a book with a troubling plot, but a plot that can be understood. God creates us out of love, but we don't want God, or we don't believe in him, or we pay very poor attention to him. Nevertheless, God continues to love us. At least, he continues to try to get our attention. Pastor Merrill made religion seem reasonable, and the trick of having faith, he said, was that it was necessary to believe in God without any great or even remotely reassuring evidence that we don't inhabit a godless universe. Although he knew all the best, or at least the least boring, stories in the Bible, Mr. Merrill was most appealing because he reassured us that doubt was the essence of faith, and not faith's opposite. By comparison, whatever the Reverend Dudley Wiggin had seen to make him believe in God, he had seen absolutely, possibly by flying an airplane too close to the sun. The rector was not gifted with language, and he was blind to doubt or worry in any form. Perhaps the problem with his eyesight that had forced his early retirement from the airlines was really a euphemism for the blinding powers of his total religious conversion, because Mr. Wiggins was fearless to an extent that would have made him an unsafe pilot, and to an extent that made him a madman as a preacher.
New England's relationship to its churches has been a complex story of change and reevaluation at many times. Although once we were theocratic, puritanical, and God-fearing, shunning dance, music, and celebration for fear of what the Almighty might think, New England has developed a far more diverse and liberal religious profile in many ways, less rigid, less political, more likely to accept the unconventional, such as gay bishops and the ordination of women. Today on Storylines New England, we're talking about religion and about John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany. And we're taking your calls, your stories of faith, religion, and spirituality in our region. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. How do you think that religion and faith have formed the character of New Englanders? Is there anything unique about New England's spiritual attitudes? Do faith, hope, or the possibility of miracles play a part in New England's outlook? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us in the studio, David Waters, professor of English at the University of New Hampshire and director of the Center for New England Culture. David's also the consulting scholar to Storylines New England. And joining us from Connecticut Public Radio, Andrew Walsh, visiting assistant professor of religion at Trinity College in Hartford and associate director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life. He's also editor of the recent book, Religion and Public Life in New England. And as Kevin said, we are taking your calls. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here on Storylines New England. We want to know if you think there's anything about New Englanders that distinguishes them in terms of their religious attitudes. Do we approach religion differently here? 1-800-892-6477. To Morristown, Vermont first, and Eric is on the air. Hello, Eric. Go ahead. Thanks for calling. Eric, you're on the air. Welcome.
Sorry, can't hear you.
Sure. Can you hear me now, Eric?
No.
You can't.
No, now I can.
You can. Yes. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
I read A Prayer for Owen Meany when it first came out maybe 20 years ago, and I took something from it on page 445, which I have had on my desk ever since, and it's something which I read and reread, and I wanted to share it with the listeners. It gives not just hope, but almost a way to approach life for those people who might find it difficult. And this is the quote. If you are lucky enough to find a way of life you love, you have to find the courage to live it. I don't know whether this had anything to do with spirituality or with religion. Perhaps it did. But I extracted it, and it's been something which has reminded me that you just can't accept life the way it is. If you want to change it, then you have to have courage.
Now, Eric, is this a quote from Owen himself?
Yes.
Okay. I just didn't remember because it's a big book, so I wasn't sure who the quote was from.
For the readers, it's on page 445.
You know, David Waters, I want to talk a little bit more with you just about Owen, because even though Johnny Wheelwright is the person telling the story, it's about Owen. Who is Owen Meany supposed to represent in this book?
Well, I think we're supposed to accept in some way that he might be a new Christ, and that his heroism in saving a group of children by grabbing a grenade and dying in the act is not just heroism, but maybe even a sacrificial martyrdom, and that it's been ordained by God. And we see Owen struggle with accepting that as his fate, which seems to have been revealed to him by God. I think for Owen, though, it's also just how can he save the people around him? How can he help Johnny overcome his incredible bitterness and anger? And, you know, it says at one point in the book, the 1960s is the decade that ruined us. It created a nation of angry young people. And how can that anger be replaced by love? And I think that's what Owen tries to say. Be not afraid. You know, have courage. Find the love in your life.
As our caller Eric tells us, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the 60s, and he keeps tying it in and tying it in. I mean, certainly no one should get the impression that this book is just about a spiritual quest. There, it's a 617-page book. There's a lot there. But one of the things that Irving does so skillfully is he melds that spiritual quest and what some might say is a political rant. I mean, him going on and on about Vietnam and the Iran-Contra. Tell us more, David, how Irving connects the political and the spiritual, again, through his characters.
Well, he's saying, what is real morality for America? And he says at one point, Americans aren't very good historians. And why in 1987 don't we remember 1967? Or why don't we remember 1637? Are we condemned to repeat the sins of the past, or can we find a new morality that's based more on acceptance of other people and other nations and not condemning people for their sins? And this is what Owen very much is infuriated by, how someone like John Kennedy, who is idolized, he's followed the great injunction to ask not what you can do for yourself but for your country, and to try to believe and have faith in America, and then he loses faith in America, and how, after America loses its innocence in the 1960s, can that faith be restored?
There's a real insistence on moral responsibility that applies in Irving not only to religious matters, but also to public policy. So I wanted to ask you, Andrew Walsh, you know, it seems as though New England's churches in general, and I know it's tricky to generalize, don't seem to be as activist in terms of matters of public policy as church leaders in other kinds of the country. And I suppose I'm thinking of fundamentalist leaders in places like the South and the Sun Belt and so on. Have New England's churches historically stayed away from meddling with what you might call public policy, or have they been more activist than we may suspect?
I think the latter is largely true, but I think that there's a distinctive style that's at play here. Protestants, and New England reflects this very strongly, chose to build a culture with institutions that supported their public values. So what New England Puritans did was create the town and the values of the town and make that a sacred thing. So where the Protestant mainline kicks in, where, you know, the places where you go to find Alcoholics Anonymous and Drug Abusers Anonymous and those kinds of things are Protestant churches. They're the ones that work together now in many places with Catholic churches to feed the poor, to run the the nonprofit agencies. The Protestants created the idea of a nonprofit agency to carry their kinds of values into a divided, religiously divided world.
So their style
doesn't work through electoral politics. It works through organizational behavior and educational behavior and charitable activity. And New England's Protestant churches are still very active there.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that churches in New England, both Protestant and Catholic, tend to operate on a small-scale personal basis with those who they can see and touch rather than in terms of big media pronouncements
I think that's the case, and I think that we're used to them doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
I remind you that the Catholic Church behaves in a big politics way in New England.
Of course.
Think about the campaign against gay marriage or against abortion.
And the sort of veiled warnings against John Kerry in certain ways during a recent election.
Yeah. And so I think that there is an important kind of distinction here. But what the claim of historic mainline Protestantism in New England is that it's in special historical ways responsible for the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes that role quite seriously. So if you go into most New England towns and ask who's on the zoning board, who runs the library, who sets up the PTO, it's very often disproportionately mainline Protestants who do that as their public life activity.
I see.
If you look at the boards of New England's museums or schools, they're still disproportionately peopled by mainline Protestants who give their money and who build institutions like, the colleges that litter the land, including mine, which are Protestant ideas.
I wouldn't call your college litter, Andrew.
There are a lot of us.
We better take another call, Andrew Walsh. Yeah. This is Jesse from South Burlington, Vermont, joining us. Hi there, Jesse.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm actually not from South Burlington. I'm visiting from upstate New York, so I'm not a native New Englander. So I do have I'm just going to ask you a comment on something. I'm very familiar with the text. I've read it maybe 35 times, and I fancy myself a bit of an Irving scholar. But anyway, one of the things that I found interesting in the text was the combination or the comparison between the descriptions of the actual physical space of the churches.
Oh yes.
And between the Episcopalian churches being kind of more ornate with the stained glass and all that, and mm-hmm. then the Protestant church being more kind of, I don't remember if it was whitewashed.
Described as light and airy and open.
Right.
In comparison.
And I was just going to ask you a comment, I guess, on how the physical space kind of reflects the ideals of the people.
Well, I want to turn that over to David Waters because I know he can tell us something about it, but I can't let it pass without saying that in my own town of Hopkinton, New Hampshire, the description of the two main churches in the village of Hopkinton matches Irving's description perfectly.
Well, great observation, Jesse, and it really is true, especially when you take it up further up the line into the Catholic churches, and that here it is, can faith be embodied in ritual objects, and can stone and stained glass communicate the miracles and the feeling of faith, or in the Protestant tradition, that more kind of intellectual, word-based, voice-based religion. And I think that's a struggle for John Wheelwright and Owen Meany. Owen Meany embodies his beliefs in granite, and for John Wheelwright it's in words. And isn't that the kind of Catholic and Protestant split, but also a split between the body and the mind?
Interesting. And, speaking of Catholics and Protestants, which we talked about earlier, I'll tell you guys a story. You said earlier, Andrew Walsh, that that southern New England is mostly Catholic with, Boston and Rhode Island and in Connecticut. When I was growing up, I grew up outside of Boston, and it was very Catholic. And then I moved to New Hampshire and realized that no Catholics actually hadn't been running the country, that it had been Protestants who'd been president the whole time. So it all depends on where you grow up. Let's take another call. This one from Rob. He's joining us from Hill, New Hampshire. Hi, Rob. Thanks for calling. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, my question is in regard to what effect, if any, did more progressive religions such as the UCC or the Unitarian Universalist churches have on New England when they first began appearing?
Good question. I'm going to throw that to you, Andrew Walsh.
Well, the Unitarians had a profound prophetic impact, but a small one historically. One of my teachers at Harvard used to say the Unitarians in the 19th century believed in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the neighborhood of Boston. And once you get outside Boston, there aren't very many Unitarians. But many of the issues that created the Unitarian movement at the turn of the 19th century crop up again, and the Congregationalists move overwhelmingly to a similar, if not exactly the same, position in the 20th century, although UCC people are much more likely to say they are Christians than Unitarians are. So it's a, you know, it's a strong trend, and there are strong genetic relationships between the two movements.
Andrew, I have one last question for you because I know you have to leave us. If you could just leave our audience with one thought about New England's religious landscape and how it might be evolving in the future, what would that be?
Well, since World War II, the great division between Catholics and Protestants has been easing off. And it happened partly because Catholics moved to the suburbs and got affluent and got educated. And so one of the great conundrums is the reason why New England, with the possible exception of New Hampshire, is such a blue region, is that Catholics and Protestants, especially educated ones, now think and vote very similarly, although they maintain very religious, different religious commitments. And how that will carry on and whether that will repudiate in the long run New England sort of bifurcated culture, I don't know, but I'm interested.
So Catholics and Protestants are becoming more alike in New England? Is that what you're saying, Andrew?
They are. They are. And they are becoming more alike in the suburbs, which is for in most parts of New England where most of the people live.
Interesting. Well, Andrew Walsh, it's really been a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Andrew Walsh, he is a visiting assistant professor of religion at Trinity College in Hartford and associate director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life. He's also editor of the recent book, Religion and Public Life in New England. And we have been talking about A Prayer for Owen Meany today in our final show on Storylines New England. David Waters, we'd be remiss if we didn't add that not only this book about politics and religion and, you know, all sorts of things, but it's terribly, terribly funny. And there's a part that John Irving does that he just sprinkles humor throughout this book. Tell us a little bit more about just how he does that.
Well, he is a really funny writer, and I think he has a kind of a tragic comic vision. What awful things happen in his books, but you know, you also just have to laugh. And we have an 11-year-old as the Christ child, and we have this little boy playing the spirit of Christmas yet to come and terrorizing the town, and his little voice convinces a basketball team to put a Volkswagen up on the stage of the chapel at Exeter. And it's this kind of comic relief that really, I think, is finally underneath his human vision, that we have to laugh about being human, and that makes us be a little more forgiving.
And that's what really brings this book together and makes it a great book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as we end the Storylines New England series that we've been doing for 13 weeks, and it certainly has been a pleasure doing this series, we want to take a look back and see what we've learned over the 13 weeks as we've examined our region's literature for clues about who we are as New Englanders, what makes us tick, what influences our politics, our belief, and how history and present issues affect the direction our region might take in the future. We're going to talk some more about that in just a minute, but let's take a quick look back now at some of our favorite Storylines New England moments.
My ancestors came here for opportunity, clearly economical opportunities. And then I think once here, they became part of a larger history, a history that had been going on for hundreds of years, and they found their way into that world and built on top of a previous world. So there's a real sense of accumulation, of already inheriting something and taking it on.
Here you have Boston, this historically tolerant city, all the way from the abolitionist days up until that particular moment. Other cities and towns had the same sorts of issues that they fought integration tooth and nail. But in Boston, because of the proximity of all the neighborhoods, you had it in your face, close, and the answer was no.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth.
Getting in the wood for the winter and doing a little trapping to bring in some extra money, knowing where the best blueberries grow and raspberries, gathering mushrooms and other things, knowing the names of things, understanding where the frost settles first so you don't put your garden there. All these things are the cumulative knowledge of generations. And you can't come into a place and learn it overnight.
People would be uncomfortable with dealing with the fact that this country is built on oppression, it's built on genocide, it's built on these sort of uncomfortable historic instances that caused the demise of millions of people so that people can be in the place that they are in right now.
New England having a sort of deep history of being a place where writers had been nurtured since the beginning of the 19th century, that New England represented a certain kind of American literary tradition. And a lot of writers at this time, Wharton included, were leaving New England and leaving America in order to go to Europe, feeling that they needed to get away from cultural restrictions that you see in a town like North Dormer.
In order to successfully go to sea, one must have a certain boldness, a certain spirit of entrepreneurship, risk-taking, and I think that especially going to ships under sail, you know, before modern conveniences, modern power, that entrepreneurship, that courage and tenacity really helped define the New England character.
You've been listening to a collection of our favorite moments from the 13 weeks here at Storylines New England as we wrap up our series tonight. Here is David Waters, our Storylines New England consulting scholar. And David, we've heard so many voices from different parts and different time periods of New England's history as time has gone on. It's been a real education for somebody like me who fancied that he knew a little something about New England to hear the diversity of viewpoints and to hear so many surprising voices that, frankly, I'd never heard before. The voice of William Epps, for instance, the voice of Dorothy West and so many others. But I'm curious. Yes, you've been our consultant. You've guided us through this list of books and authors. You've helped us find guests. You've enlightened us about all sorts of things. As you have listened to the series and as you've contemplated what's come out of Storylines, have you learned anything? Have you heard anything you hadn't heard before? What surprised you about what you've heard?
Well, what a pleasure it has been to think about these books as a group, but really to hear what people have wanted to say about them, the callers that have come in, and how you, Kevin, and Laura have encouraged conversation, because that's what keeps books alive. And I think it really has shown to me how powerful images of New England still are, not only for the people who live here, but also for the writers, that it is still very much a special place, that there's a set of images, whether it's the church at the common, whether it's the factory building, whether it's the rock-bound coast, or whether it's the images of the people, you know, the Yankees, black Yankees and white Yankees, the Irish Catholics, or whether it's the Lebanese American farmers struggling to make a go of it, that people still care about these things and that they really still seem to mean something, not just in New England, but for Americans in general.
What do you think the audience has taken away from this, David? I mean, you, again, are the scholar who knows a lot about New England, but just broadly, what do you think the audience has taken away?
Well, I think that we still see New England voices as strong storytellers, that this is a place of origins, that there's some stories here that get told really, really well.
Right, and a lot started here, didn't it?
Yeah, a lot started, and that these stories are worth going back to, that this is what makes books classics, that as times change, we can find new meanings in them. And I think going back to Native American writers, or going back to Peyton Place, or going back to Edith Wharton Summer, that we understand that these struggles for ways of living in a modern life, we can learn something from the past. But I hope most of all people have realized that there's still great new literature, that the classics of tomorrow are being written today. Mm-hmm. We do have a Spartina by John Casey, or All Souls, a family story from Southie by Michael Patrick McDonald. That's a story that needed to be told, and that's what the series has really done for me, is to give a sense of of what important writers are working in New England.
It must have been particularly challenging to work on compiling this list, which has some, you know, if you think about all the thousands of writers that have come out of New England, how difficult it must have been to reduce it to simply 13. Are there any writers you wish had been on this list or that you might put on another Storylines New England
list? I get that comment all the time. Why isn't this one on? Why isn't that one on? Why didn't you pick so-and-so?
Well, I think of Mark Doty, a fantastic poet and the author of a wonderful AIDS memoir, Heaven's Coast, and I think of a very new writer, one novel about New England, Danzy Senna, who wrote Caucasia, which is about passing for white in New Hampshire, and it's just a rollicking comic take on our region. And I think Jen, too, would be a wonderful addition as well.
You know, Kevin, this isn't fair, but I'm your co-host. What'd you learn?
Well, you know, I think what surprised me most was not things that I thought I knew something about. For instance, Annie Proulx's talk about the tension between insiders and outsiders in small rural places, or even the insights that Grace Metalius has to offer about life in a small town.
Because you grew up in a small town, Hopkinton, New Hampshire, right.
But I was fascinated and most enlightened by Dorothy West's discussion of life in upper-class black society at the turn of the 20th century in Boston, or the things that Michael McDonald had to say about his life in South Boston, even as late as the 1970s. Yeah. And I think I was enormously impressed and educated by the articulate agony of William Epps, as I mentioned before, in his discussion of the treatment of Native Americans in New England in the early 19th century. So that list is much longer than I've got time to give here, but I feel like I've gone through something of a college course in what New England really does have to offer in terms of literature. How about you?
I have sort of dual New England citizenship. I grew up on the coast. so John Irving's book, Spartina, spoke a lot to me, and I knew a lot of people like the main character in that book, you know, sort of old salts. So I know people like that, so that was fun. I also, again, grew up on the coast just outside of Boston during the time of the race riots in Boston. I remember reading about, you know, just seeing the headlines in the paper as a child, but not really knowing what that was all about. So that was fascinating. And, of course, now, you know, grew up as a teenager in New Hampshire and have been in New Hampshire, so it's been wonderful learning about, you know, kind of taking the lid off of those picture postcard towns that the tourists come to see. That's been fun. I guess Grace Metalius was one of my favorites on that one. And David Waters, it's really just been a pleasure. And thank you so much for working with us and for being here tonight.
Well, you're welcome, Laura. And thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, David. For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, go to our website at storylines.ala.org.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help today from Dan Colgan and Rebecca Kaufman. David Elliott performed our readings.
Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott, and Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries. The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Azalis. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Thank you so much for joining us these 13 weeks on Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. We want to hear what you think about our 13-part series, Storylines New England. What did you like, and what didn't you like? And would you want to hear more of this program in the future?
Send your comments in an email to publicprograms, all one word, at ala.org. That's publicprograms, one word, at ala.org. And thanks.